Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you today?
I'm great.
You know, they've changed the law in New York recently. It used to be that if you wanted to distill spirits in New York State, you needed to buy a $50,000 industrial class license, or you could only distill fruit brandy if you had a farm.
Really?
That's a lot. But they've changed the law. You ready for this? There's a new type of license for $1,450. You can distill up to 35,000 gallons a year of any inebriant. That's a word I didn't know existed, actually, until I read the piece in the Times. 35,000 gallons. I mean, that's
inebriant.
Enough.
Sounds enough like something you got to clean your house with before you paint it.
That's enough for me and my whole family. Yeah. Well, last summer, there were two guys, Mr. Enzo and Mr. Lee, who started a distillery up in Hudson Valley where they're making spirits. And this is local stuff, and I think it's really interesting. And they're the first guys to get this license, and they have two vodkas distilled from local apples, an unaged corn whiskey, and a bourbon, which they age in oak barrels, and that'll be bottled at the end of summer. I think to be called a bourbon, they're going to have to send it down to Kentucky to get it bottled.
So why aren't they making apple brandies? Why are they making vodkas?
I don't know. Let's call them. Let's get them on the show.
I like it. I like it.
Jason?
Good idea.
Call them and get them on the show. We should probably call them up. I think that'd be very interesting.
Yeah,
but
I do
actually,
too.
What they're saying is the two vodkas they make are, you know how all these vodka companies are talking about triple distilled, quadruple distilled, quintuple distilled? Well, what these guys have done is they've done a low distillation, and they've distilled it from apples. Now, what vodka means is I think it's a high level of proof, and it doesn't have a lot of apple character, but they say that in the vodka, in their first vodka, the apple essence is there, and it has like a rosy color to it. I'm sorry, not a rosy color, but a rosy nose to it that is of in the essence of apples, and I think that's pretty darn interesting. They say, Ralph Enzo, who's one of the distillers, says, no, it's not vodka with apple flavoring. It's just pure vodka that we distill from apples. Heart of Hudson Vodka has a palpable presence of apples, a wholesome freshness that survived the distillation and rises invitingly from the glass. So they don't do the multiple filterings and distillations to make a clean spirit that tastes like nothing. I can't wait to try this. And then they have one that they distill again called a V vodka, which loses a lot of the apple flavor to it. And that's right here in Hudson Valley. I think that artisanal spirits like that right here in Hudson Valley from a pot still, which is an unusual way to distill vodka.
That's interesting. You know, as long as we're talking about Hudson Valley, there was another article, and we've been talking about foie gras, so I won't talk about it too long. But there's a new motion on the floor that groups that want foie gras declared an adulterated food within the meaning of Article 17, Section 200 of the Agriculture and Markets Law. The Agriculture Commission would then have the option of banning foie gras. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to call it an adulterated food. And Eric Repairs, he's the chef of Le Bernardin, one of the all-time great responses, I think, to this whole issue.
Give it to me.
Ready? Eric Repair, this is from the New York Times. Eric Repair, Anthony Ramirez is the author. Eric Repair, executive chef and co-owner of Le Bernardin, acclaimed French restaurant in Manhattan, uttered a long sigh in an interview. We can criticize how foie gras is produced, he said, and be concerned about the health of the duck, and blah, 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 okay, fine. Well said, Eric. I'm with you 100%.
Let's get Eric Repair on the show. Look, Mark and I are against cruelty to animals. The raising of foie gras ducks is much more humane than the beef or the chicken or anything else that's on your supermarket shelf or the fur you wear on your back.
Okay? Hold on one more time.
Go ahead.
And be concerned about the health of the duck and blah, 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 blah. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
That's a great quote from one of the greatest chefs in the country.
I'm with him. I want to get him on the show to talk about that. The title of the show will be blah, 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 blah.
That was beautiful.
All right, I have a summer recipe for everybody. This is one of my favorite things to do in the summer, and I know that you do it too. It's an old Italian...
Excuse me, I don't think so.
Well, you know you do.
There's a whole slew of things that I do that you do in the summer that I have nothing to do with.
It's the peaches and red wine trick.
Oh, the grandpa used to do this one. This is in my family for years and years and years and years.
If you take... A lot of times you get peaches and they're underripe.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there is nothing better than a perfectly ripe peach, and there's nothing better than a perfectly ripe local white peach that's mm-hmm. picked at the peach. And these peaches are like, almost always only get them at farmer's markets. They get them local and perfectly ripe when they're picked ripe.
Right, otherwise they
Because, I mean, you look
them.
At these wrong and they bruise.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you bite into them and, like, the juice of the peach runs down your arm and drips off your elbow onto the ground, and it's like the beautiful red of summer. But for most of the time, when we get underripe peaches, whether they're white or yellow peaches, you can take those peaches, slice them up, take the pits out, throw them in a bottle of red wine. Now, it should be something like maybe a Cabernet or maybe a Shiraz, something with a lot of fruit to it. You don't want something light.
I think Grandpa used the O'Peachy gallon jug.
I'm pretty sure of red. We've upgraded. And what you do is you take your sliced peaches and you throw them in, you put them in a bowl, you cover them in red wine till they're covered,
mm-hmm.
and you leave them in the refrigerator for 5 hours.
Oh, we would leave them sometimes for 2 days.
Yeah, but they're best at 5 hours. And one of the things that can happen, depending on the wine you use, is overnight they can get bitter. I have left them too long.
Mm-hmm.
But you leave them in the red wine for 5 hours, and they just, the peaches seem to almost ripen floating in the red wine.
Yep.
And you can pick at them. And then the red wine, and use a decent red wine that you would drink,
because
you can then pour the red wine into a glass, and it's a chilled, light red wine with a little peach infusion.
I mean, every summer we did that in my family. But maybe we should do that at Kath Lombardi. Maybe we should do the red wine peaches.
And you can take the peaches out and put them in a bowl, like, off the red wine, and put, like, some whipped cream or something on them if you want.
Yeah,
or you just pick
cream.
Them out and
little
eat them.
Ice cream.
Oh, and ice
cream. It was great. We did it every summer.
And the adults can drink the wine. There's another summertime when strawberries are in season. There's another Italian recipe that's... And, you know, if you're talking about a dessert that's good for you, that doesn't have a lot of fat, I mean, this is great for dessert or just to have in the refrigerator for people to pick on. But another one is we do this a lot for people who really want dessert and can't have any fat or a lot of sugar. You take really good local strawberries. You slice them up.
Mm-hmm.
You crack black pepper on top of them right when you're about to serve them. Don't let them steep at all. But right when you're about to serve them on the plate, you crack black pepper from a peppercorn from a pepper mill. And then we like to use old balsamic vinegar. Old balsamic vinegar is very expensive, but like a teaspoon works. It's thick. It's almost like honey. It's sweet. And old balsamic, 20-year-old balsamic vinegar, 12-year-old balsamic vinegar, it's lost its acidity. It's sweet.
What some people will do in order to get that same effect, and you can do at home, is you can reduce your vinegars. It won't be as good as the aged method of balsamic vinegar, but it's a way of cheating and that you could do at home.
And to reduce it, you just take some good balsamic vinegar from Modena in Italy. Okay, it has to be from Modena in Italy, and you cook it down in a pan until it starts to get thick.
So yeah, until it gums up a little bit, not too much.
And that's a reduced balsamic vinegar, or you can use the old stuff, which is naturally thick by 20 years of age and much more expensive. You put the strawberries on the plate, you crack a little pepper over them, you put the balsamic vinegar over the top, and you have a marvelous and sophisticated and traditional dessert.
Just another little addition to that, if you can shave a little like hard goat cheese or something over the top of
it,
it's a great little addition to that.
Or Parmesan or Reggiano, it would be amazing. Okay, I hope you've enjoyed the first segment of the show. Come right back where you're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, stage left in Kath Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Ted Breaux. Ted's a chemist and an environmental microbiologist who, in his spare time, as it were, has become one of the foremost authorities in the world on absinthe, which is a substance, which is a liquor that is banned in the United States but is available in almost every other civilized country in the world. Besides being a knowledgeable source on the subject, he's also distilling some of the best absinthe available, and he's here to talk with us today. Hey there, Ted.
How are you?
We're doing great. Thanks for joining us on The Restaurant Guys.
Ted, you know, Francis said that it's available in some of the every other civilized nation in the world. It's actually available in some uncivilized nations as well, isn't it?
Why, Ted, can you share with us and our listeners, I mean, we sort of know the answer, why is absinthe illegal while Bacardi 151 is legal?
Well, absinthe was originally banned in the U.S. in 1912, and when those laws were superseded by the modern FDA regs in around 71 or so, basically at that time, everyone had pretty much forgotten about absinthe. And it's no longer banned specifically, but effectively, the content is won't meet FDA standards. So that's why we don't have absinthe sold in U.S. liquor stores.
What about it doesn't meet FDA standards?
Well, in short, there's a the principal herb used in the distillation of absinthe is an herb, Artemisia absinthium, which is what absinthe derives its name. And any finished food or beverage that is made with Artemisia absinthium must be thujone free. Thujone is just one of the essences that's found in the plant that years ago was thought to be it was basically isolated as the purported compound that caused the mysterious effects associated with absinthe, which we now know just aren't true.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the lore of absinthe and you know, it was thought to originally make drive people crazy and to do crazy things. And
it made Van Gogh cut his ear off.
Van Gogh had a lot of problems.
That's all I was going to say, yeah. I mean, by the way, if you look at his paintings and you saw the world the way he does, I'd cut my ear off, too.
I'd probably drink a lot as well.
Beautiful painting. So what is the lore, L-O-R-E, of absinthe? I mean, it was the drink of choice for generations of course, the artists who made it famous, but for generations of people around the world. I mean, what is the lore of absinthe?
Well, listen, for a period of over 100 years, people drank absinthe. I mean, many, many people, millions of people, in some cases drank it almost daily with, never suffered any effects beyond that of ordinary, any other alcoholic beverage. But absinthe was originally invented as a medicine, and it became a tipple with the returning soldiers who had acquired a taste for it. It was issued to them as a rationed medicine to purify impure waters. They came back, they had this taste for it. They began drinking absinthe, and suddenly absinthe, which was a regional product of a very specific rural area of France and Switzerland, suddenly became a national sensation, and it became extremely popular. And what happened is back in the 1870s, 1880s, anyone who's a wine expert, will tell you that during that time in France, the vineyards were ravaged by phylloxera.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is a plant louse that attacked almost every vineyard in the world and really decimated the
and the French were without their wine.
The grapes.
French were without their wine for quite some time, like a decade or so. And fortunately, their vineyards were saved by American rootstock. But and they love it when you tell them that.
Yeah. But, well, they also the plant louse that caused phylloxera was brought to them on American rootstock. So it's really six of one, half dozen of the other.
Well, anyway, so what happened is absinthe at that time, wine at that time was scarce and expensive, and absinthe replaced wine as a favorite tipple in France.
Mm-hmm.
And when the wine industry came back, suddenly they found themselves at a disadvantage. And, absinthe by far and large came from a very small region of France, which is quite rural. Wine, on the other hand, is made everywhere. So what happened is the wine lobby, which was well-funded, found themselves with some unusual bedfellows in the Temperance League, which wanted to ban all alcoholic beverages. And what they did is they came up with some hokey science and claimed that absinthe was bad for you. And basically, in the warehouses of Paris, which you had, I mean, you were talking about a time before there were food and beverage quality control laws. In the warehouses of Paris, you had these guys taking alcohol and putting some plant oils in it and using some synthetic dyes like copper salts to make it artificially green. And, people who are alcoholics of low socioeconomic status were buying these cheap industrial adulterated absinthe, if you want to call it
absinthe
that.
Absinthe ripoffs.
Right.
Exactly, ripoffs.
Faux absinthe.
Exactly. And they were having health problems, and the wine industry used it to conveniently lump it all together. And you see, absinthe is bad for you. And they worked hard on that, promoting that for about 30 years, and they wanted to ban it. And you have to understand, for perspective's sake, and think about the artists and the painters, we're talking about a time when there was no such thing as an illegal substance.
Right.
I mean, every illicit, drug that we know today that existed then was completely legal. So here you have these artists and these painters, and who are drinking absinthe because it's quite trendy, and they like it, and they see all this activity of these groups trying to ban it, And they're like, who are these people that are trying to tell us what we can't drink?
Right.
Well, so Absinthe became an icon of freedom.
When we come back, I really want you to tell us about some of the incidents that led up to the banning of Absinthe.
Our guest is Ted Breaux. He's talking to us about Absinthe, which was banned around the world, and the rest of the world's come to their senses, but America and Canada have yet to. But they will soon. And we'll also tell you when you travel abroad where you can locate some Absinthe. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Ted Breaux. He's a chemist and environmental microbiologist. He was also one of the world's foremost authorities on Absinthe. Now, Ted, we were talking before the break about how Absinthe became illegal around the world. How did that happen?
Well, it became illegal... basically what happened is in France, when France entered the First World War, they banned all spirits. So, and Absinthe was banned just before that time.
Why?
Well, basically...
I've read some stuff, Ted, where, in 1905, a man shot his pregnant wife and his children, and it was because he had a couple glasses of Absinthe. And...
Right, and that was in Switzerland. Switzerland, and that was instrumental in Switzerland banning Absinthe in 1910. And like I said, the wine lobby and researchers with some very, very hokey science, just all this propaganda they generated finally gained enough momentum to force a banning on Absinthe in France, which they did in 1914.
So, but it wasn't the Absinthe that was causing all these people to do all these crazy things?
Well, there weren't that many people that were doing crazy things, but the few that were these people that were drinking these adulterated products. I mean, unlike a wine or a modern spirit, there was no appellation of control on Absinthe.
Mm-hmm.
And the major Absinthe makers petitioned for this, but French fell on deaf ears. The French government never did it. So there was never any distinction between a quality Absinthe, which is an artisanal product, and something that is just an adulterated mess that was, made in a warehouse somewhere.
So now, Absinthe then became illegal in almost all the countries of Europe and the countries of the world. When did it become legal and available again over there?
Well, in 1988, the European Union homogenized all their food and beverage quality control laws. When they did that, basically superseded all the old laws that banned Absinthe specifically. So suddenly, in all the European Union countries, Absinthe became legal. However, with modern standards, we have the safeguards in place to ensure that you're not going to get a substandard product that could be deleterious to one's health.
Well, and I'll tell you, there are some very interesting things about this product that was lost for so long and has been brought back. And I've had Absinthe on many occasions myself, and it's delicious. But your Absinthe are very unique, and how you brought them back and the rituals surrounding it and how you should drink it is something we're going to talk about when we come back from the news. It's pretty cool stuff, and there's nothing like it in the world. A lot of knockoffs, but there's nothing quite like real Absinthe. Our guest is Ted Breaux. He's one of the foremost experts on Absinthe, this substance, this liquor that's still banned in the United States of America, and we're going to talk about how you can go abroad and have a drink after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
We're talking with Ted Breaux. He's a chemist and environmental microbiologist who's also one of the world's foremost authorities on absinthe, who also makes several absinthes, but not in this country where absinthe is ridiculously still illegal. You know, Ted, I want to let people know who don't sort of get it. There are lots of absinthe knockoff kind of things that are available now. There's a product called Absente. Pastis is a knockoff of is a replacement for absinthe.
Even Pernod was a spinoff of absinthe.
It's an absinthe replacement. What's the romance of absinthe? I mean, why don't you tell people about the ritual of how absinthe is served and what it tastes like and why it's called La Muse Verte and all that stuff.
Well, you know, originally, if you look at why absinthe was popular, it's because it was a delicious drink that went down very easily, yet was surprisingly potent and had a unique flavor and was a very artisanal drink.
And what is the flavor? It's licorice, right? It's an anise-based flavor.
Well, we call it licorice, but actually the flavor in a fine absinthe comes from the seed of green anise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different from what you're going to find in something like modern Pernod liqueur, which uses Chinese star anise.
Right.
So we're getting down to the nitty gritty here.
Right, right.
And there are plenty of knockoff products out there. Most of those come from the Czech Republic, Germany, you know, Eastern European, and basically those countries, which were not, you know, absinthe was never banned in those countries, mostly because it was never popular there, and. The thing about it is most of those inferior knockoffs are marketed such that they play upon the myths of absinthe. And some of these sellers that sell knockoff products promote notions such as it'll make you hallucinate,
yeah.
Things like that, which are really, really bad because it's that type of misinformation which caused paranoia that got absinthe banned in the first place.
Well, I want to talk for a second about and Francis alluded to this a second ago, about the rituals of serving absinthe, okay, because I'm one of the guys who had to put up, when Francis came back from one of his trips to Europe, had to put up with having an absinthe drip behind my bar, even though we didn't have any absinthe.
I use it for pastis. It worked beautifully.
So
why don't you tell people about the absinthe drip.
Well, originally absinthe, if you look on the label of any old image of a bottle of absinthe from the 1800s, you'll see that it says estrade absinthe, extract of absinthe. And what it was a concentrated product originally developed as a medicine. So it isn't something that was meant to be taken neat. Originally, this medicine was, you know, to be added to water as sort of a way to dilute it to make it palatable. And that's probably where the French drip ritual evolved. And to some people, it was, you know, there's this rumor that absinthe was a very bitter product, and that's not true. It has a distinct flavor of anise, and they're also very interesting herbal background notes. And the French, who tend to like things very sweet as it is, would sometimes mask those background notes by adding sugar to the drink, which of course just made it, you know, very sweet.
Mm. And how the drip usually worked is cold water was one drop at a time dripped through a sugar cube and into the. The absinthe.
And
yeah, almost like a tea ritual, and there were specific accoutrements to doing this. There were specialized absinthe spoons that had no other purpose. There were specialized absinthe glassware. There were absinthe fountains, and there are all sorts of neat little gadgets and devices that promoted the, you know, very popular ritual of preparing an absinthe.
And I want to, you know, make people realize that this was not just like a passing fancy. We were selling millions and millions of bottles of absinthe in the world.
Just so you all understand out there in Radio Land, I don't think that we've been really clear. What you would do when you went into an absinthe bar is there would be a fountain that basically dripped water in front of each stool in many of them, where you would take the absinthe and put it in a glass, put it in a wide-mouth footed glass, neat, with nothing in it, and then you'd put an absinthe spoon, which is basically a slotted spoon, over the glass. Then you'd put a sugar cube on the slotted spoon. You'd put the glass under the fountain where it would drip, 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 drip until the sugar cube had been dissolved and was gone and into the absinthe. And the absinthe, which is green and clear, sort of like antifreeze, turns cloudy and milky as the water adds to it.
Which is, I believe, by the way, the antifreeze look is how a lot of the counterfeit absinthe got into the market.
Well,
the antifreeze aesthetic.
Well, that was, you know, so all when absinthe was made illegal, there were absinthe bars where you would go and have all of these accoutrements often built into the bar. And I'll always remember, Ted, I was at a garage sale, and I picked up, God, when I was 22 years old, I picked up this thing. It was looked like some kind of a water dispenser, and the guy who sold it to me said, yeah, it's a water dispenser, but it leaks. And I kept it because I thought it was really cool, and I eventually lost track of it. And I realized when I was 30 what it was, and I thought, oh, my God, that was an absinthe drip. And it was this ornate metal thing with a glass ball, and the little thing would drip off the bottom of it, and I'd give my left arm to find out where that thing went to.
I, you know, it's funny because I'd give your left arm to find out what happened to.
So how do people drink absinthe today when they drink it in places where it's legal? I mean, are there absinthe bars again, or do people have portable absinthe drips?
Well, if you travel to an establishment in Europe that serves absinthe, a better absinthe, what you're going to find is they'll have the glasses and the spoons and. And one can enact the ritual right then and there.
Will they have a drip?
Yeah, as far as the fountains, now those are, you know, the original fountains are very rare and expensive. Just now, just recently, there have been some quality reproductions of the original bistro fountains, so those are obtainable for reasonable money. And very few bars have those, but it's also a very nice addition to a bar. Serves that sense.
If you want to sort of participate in the ritual, you can do this with pastis or pernod. It sort of works fairly well. And there's a pastis available. It's available in New York. It's not available in New Jersey yet. Mark and I are working on it. Called La Muse Verte, which is the Green Muse, which was the nickname for absinthe. And you can get a fountain through La Muse Verte. If you email us, we'll tell you how to do that, because that's not alcoholic. I'll tell you I can do it. It's expensive, but they're really remarkable conversation pieces to have at home. Now, if people want to find out more, Ted, about real absinthe, and maybe, you know, for if they travel abroad or if they, want to do what they can to try and experience real absinthe, you have a website they can go to, right?
Yeah, the website that they can go to, which serves as a portal to us, is www.vintageabsinthe.com.
And we'll put that on our website so people can get to it without.
I appreciate that.
Without
and also,
having to worry about how to spell absinthe.
And one thing people, it's really interesting because even if you go to places like France and Switzerland, which are the birthplaces of absinthe, you'll find that just about anywhere you go, there's still a lot of myth and misinformation that persists about it. And fortunately, there are some decent resources and some decent books that are being published and that are accessible, that where one can learn a bit about absinthe and learn how to determine, you know, which products are better and what quality guidelines are in place as far as absinthe. And,
Now, Ted, we explained the whole ritual about how the water is dripped over the ice cube and slowly added to the absinthe. Is there any reason that people shouldn't just pour water and sugar in there and add it quickly? Is there any benefit to the flavor and taste by following the rituals of drinking absinthe, of letting it drip in slowly over an ice cube?
Well, if you go back and read the old poetry and prose from the time, what you'll find is that often it's said that that when dripping water into an absinthe, one should take his time, such as not to rush it, just as he wouldn't want to rush a nice woman. there's some other interesting descriptions as to what happens if you add the water too fast, and they allude to the urine of an interesting animal. But in actuality, if the idea is not just to pour the water in and rush it, but by letting the ice water slowly drip into the drink, what it does, it causes some of these essences to come out of solution, and they become aerated, and they perfume the room.
And I'll tell you, when you see that absinthe ritual being done, and when we have a brand new absinthe fountain on the way that we're going to use with pastis in the restaurant sometime in the fall when it gets here, it's being imported from France, a very beautiful glass crystal thing. It's really wild to watch it drip into your glass and take the time and watch that stuff change color before you drink it. And if you know the history and ritual of the history. Or history of the ritual, it's even more fascinating. We'll come back in just a moment talking more with Ted Breaux. He's one of the world's top authorities on absinthe, and we'll be back with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Ted Breaux. He is one of the world's foremost authorities on absinthe, which is still banned in the United States and Canada. If you want to find out more about absinthe and how to get your hands on some, you might have to travel abroad to do it or whatever. www.vintageabsinthe.com. We'll put that up on our website.
Ted, is it illegal to carry absinthe into the country, or is it just illegal to sell it?
Well, look, technically it's prohibited to take any food or beverage product that has not specifically been approved for importation. I'm talking brand, everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an administrative issue. You know, it's like taking any other bottle of liquor that you find anywhere that maybe isn't distributed in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like a banned subject like a Cuban cigar.
No.
I'm not going to get cited for trading with the enemy.
No. Not like that. Basically, what you would just do is you would take the bottle in and declare it as a bottle of liquor, and it's not anything that anyone's going to be terribly concerned about.
All right, now let's go back here. Now, we had absinthe, which was illegal across the world for a long period of time. You're fascinated with old spirits and that sort of thing. Absinthe again becomes legal in Europe, but the craft has been lost. It's not passed down from father to son anymore. It's been illegal for many years and forgotten about. How do you recreate the true absinthe from, you know, knockoffs are far away from what the old absinthe was,
which nobody's made for 80 years.
So how did you go about creating the original absinthes again?
Well, I tell you, that was quite a journey for me. And really, if you look at all the commercial absinthes in existence today, I'm talking maybe like 5% of them are actually made somewhat in accordance to the proper way to make absinthe. So unfortunately, it's just a very, very small, you know, section of the market, which involves quality products. As far as me, when I got started and I became interested in absinthe back in 93, there were no commercial absinthes. I'm an American, you know, and I'm trying to study absinthe. It's very, very difficult at that point in time to find any information on absinthe, and what little information I could find was always of dubious and questionable quality. And I became interested, I had an interest in liquor chemistry at the time because I had, while studying chemistry in university, I was working in fine drinking establishments where I had to learn a lot about liquor.
Mm-hmm.
So those two interests sort of merged, and upon really becoming interested in absinthe in 93, I became so intrigued with it because all I could really find was some allusions to hallucinations and deleterious effects on health, and I questioned all that.
Did you find old recipes?
Well, I did, but you know, it's kind of like an old recipe is like a paragraph of information that assumes that whoever reads it or uses it is very well experienced in the art. I mean, I could very easily write a recipe on how Chateau Latour is made.
Right.
That doesn't mean you're going to be able to go out and make it yourself.
So what did you do? What extraordinary measures did you take to find out how to reproduce the old absinthe?
Well, what I did was I struggled quite a bit with it until I could find a piece of the puzzle that would enable me to complete the whole picture, and that being a bottle of unopened vintage absinthe. And I searched for quite a while, and suddenly I came across two of them.
Wow. At like an estate sale, I hear?
Yeah, that was one was an estate sale where someone just flagged it and brought it to my attention, and I happened across it. And at the same time, I mean, within 30 days of that, I had a very good friend who came across one. It was an heirloom. It had been passed to the family and never been opened.
So now you've got these old bottles of absinthe. How do you get from having an unopened old bottle of absinthe to being able to make a new one?
Well, it's akin to forensic chemistry. What I had to do was take samples from these unopened bottles, which fortunately were two very well-respected brands, and I subjected them to chemical analysis, which, of course, I, in my profession as an environmental scientist, I conduct regularly. And it took quite a while for me to go through and identify every significant compound in these absinthes and determine what was the origin of that compound and do research in these compounds and see if I could find anything that would support the age-old myth that it was that there was something in absinthe that was deleterious to health, which, of course, I found that there was nothing of the sort.
But it also helped you find the recipe.
It also did, because what it enabled me to do, it opened up a whole new world of detail. I'm talking detail of, you know, when you look at a list of herbs, well, it's, I mean, where those herbs are grown, how they're harvested,
mm-hmm.
all key elements in the end result.
And you can figure out that out from the chemistry of the sample.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And so now you've recreated some of these, I don't want to say ancient, but 100-year-old absinthe?
Extinct absinthe. Yes, I've done that. And the challenge in doing this, you know, once you know what's in it, then you've got to go back and find these original materials so that the end product is like the original product. And you know, it's kind of like, imagine going into a museum and finding a 1902 Oldsmobile, you know, and trying to recreate it.
Right, you got to go find the parts.
And a lot of the materials that we're used to make just don't exist anymore because mm-hmm. they're so archaic.
Well, listen, the vintageabsinthe.com is going to get us to you, but what are the names of the absinthes that you are producing that are now winning medals around the world as clearly the finest absinthes produced?
The three that I'm producing presently are Absinthe Nouvelle Orléans, which is something that is based upon an absinthe that appeared in New Orleans before the ban, and absinthe was very popular in New Orleans.
Actually, you know what? We're going to have to hold it right there. We're going to take a quick break for a commercial. We'll come right back. We're talking with Ted Breaux about absinthe, which is illegal in the United States but available in the rest of the world. And Ted, an American, is making some of the best absinthe in the world. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Ted Breaux. He is a chemist and an environmental microbiologist who's one of the foremost experts on absinthe in the world. And he's also producing three of the top quality absinthes anywhere. One of them is Nouvelle Orléans, which we talked about earlier. And we'll tell you how to get there through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. What are the other two absinthes that are?
The other two are an absinthe called Vert Suisse, which is a painstaking reproduction of the original Swiss Burger 65, which was very, very popular in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And the third is an absinthe called Edward, which is an exact reproduction of a very popular brand of absinthe, Edward Pernod, which was a very fine absinthe around in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And all three of these products are very artisanal, and they're accurate down to a painstaking detail.
And since all these companies are defunct, nobody cares that you're making them.
No, nobody really cares. Well, the thing about these companies is even where remnants of the companies exist, it's not the same company, and they really don't even have any records of the original product.
Well, and the other thing I want to talk about is when they say that absinthe was supposedly, it made people mad because it contained in the wormwood that was used as an ingredient in absinthe, it would produce thujone, which was something that would cause people to go crazy. When you did your analysis of those old bottles of absinthe, you found out that there wasn't really any thujone that could do anything. Is that correct?
That's right. What I found is, contrary to what had been hypothesized in the late 1980s in a couple of published articles, that the levels, concentrations of thujone in original absinthe was very, very low, much wow. lower than expected.
Hey, Ted, thanks for all the information. I mean, it was fascinating to talk to you about this fascinating topic. It's been great to have you.
It's been great to be here, and I really enjoyed speaking with you guys.
Super. Now, that's Ted Breaux. He's one of the top experts in the world on absinthe. You can find out more information about him, about the absinthes that are available, and about absinthe substitutes on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. I'll also throw up there for you a couple of cocktails that are made with Pernod and other absinthe substitutes like that are really great.
And absinthe is an alcoholic beverage, but it's kind of a very different effect than you get from other alcohols.
Yeah, and it's one I like a lot. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.